This podcast is a part of Sphera,
a collective of independent media outlets from across Europe.
For more information,
visit sphera-hub.com.
Hello, Katie.
Hello from sunny London.
Yeah, it feels rather inappropriate on this incredibly sunny day here, also in Amsterdam, that we've decided to make an episode about rain this week.
It's so ill-timed.
But I guess we've got listeners all over the world, and somewhere one of them will be listening with the pitter-patter of rain
exactly
on their windows.
It's like the opposite of, what's it called? It's always sunny in Philadelphia. It's the opposite of that. It's always raining somewhere in Europe.
Very true. So yeah, this episode is for you guys listening in rainy places. I'm sorry you're missing out on the wonderful sun that Katie and I both have. But we are heading to Gothenburg in Sweden to speak to Jens Toms Ivarsson, a man who has been given a most brilliantly bizarre job by the city of Gothenburg. As part of the city's 400-year anniversary celebrations, he's been put in charge of trying to make Gothenburg the best city in the world when it rains.
I love this idea.
We're going to be having a nice chat with him later on in the show to find out a bit more about this intriguing sounding brief. Who's had a good week, Katie?
I am giving good week to People Power in Budapest because thousands of people came out onto the streets over the weekend in the Hungarian capital in protest over these big plans to build a new European campus for a fairly prestigious Chinese university. How much have you heard about this, by the way? Because this is one of those stories that I've kind of seen around for a few weeks, but I have to confess it had kind of passed me by till now.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same, so I'm really glad you're talking about it.
Well, I live to serve. I will do my best to fill you in. So back in April, Viktor Orban's government signed a deal with Fudan University. It is a university based in Shanghai. It's ranked as the 100th best uni in the world, so it's pretty good in the grand scheme of things. And under this new deal, a new campus for this Chinese university would be built on this huge old industrial site in Budapest, right next to the Danube River. And it would be massive, this campus, 500,000 square meters. And the government has obviously hailed this as a good thing. It would mean huge numbers of Chinese and international students coming to Budapest. Realistically, quite a lot of them would be pretty rich students. And so all of these people would be coming in and stimulating the economy and helping to make Budapest feel, you know, even more vibrant and cosmopolitan and culturally interesting than it already is.
Okay, that sounds kind of nice, but I sense that there's a catch. Is it something to do with who's paying for it?
Well, that is definitely one big reason why people are so pissed off about it. There's a Hungarian investigative website called Direct36. They do really good work holding powerful people to account in Hungary. And they had revealed that a huge amount of taxpayer money is going into building this Chinese university, like 1.5 billion euros,
whoa,
which is more than Hungary's entire higher education budget. And the vast majority of this money is going to be borrowed from China, 1.3 billion euros.
Oh.
And that got people's alarm bells ringing, because actually it's kind of part of a pattern. Hungary is already borrowing heavily from China to build a new railway. And generally in recent years, Orban has been cozying up to the Chinese government. He's been trying to position himself as that guy in Europe who is willing to work very closely with the Chinese Communist Party and not ask too many awkward questions about human rights.
And doesn't that tie in with the fact that Hungary, I think, are the only European country that are using the Chinese COVID vaccine?
Yeah, and it's a perfectly good vaccine. But the fact that Hungary has gone its own way and started using it when the rest of Europe isn't, it's something that's been seen as part of this kind of reangling of Hungary away from the rest of the EU and towards China. And cozying up to China is something that obviously makes a lot of pro-European Hungarians feel pretty uncomfortable. Like, it goes without saying that China's government is both incredibly powerful and incredibly sinister. It is committing human rights abuses on an absolutely massive scale against the Uyghurs, just to give one example. And look, it would be really hypocritical to suggest that other governments in Europe don't also want to work with China, because we buy so much of their stuff, you know? The EU is, as we speak, trying to negotiate a new Chinese investment deal. So that's awkward. But I do think it's fair to say that Orbán's approach to China has really been one of like unabashed enthusiasm. His government is putting out the stop to welcome Chinese money. And that shows itself in things like the terms of the deal for building this new university. There is a Chinese construction firm being brought in to build it. Local companies weren't given a look in. So there's a lot of people saying, well, hang on a second, we're taking on loads of Chinese debt to build this place. It is being built by a Chinese company. Who actually benefits from this? The other thing is that Fudan University is known to be pretty close to the Chinese Communist Party. And in terms of its values, it did something quite worrying a couple of years ago. It changed its charter to remove any references to freedom of thought. So that doesn't feel like something that would be really great for academic freedoms in Hungary, necessarily.
It feels pretty poignant that Budapest is welcoming this new Chinese university a few years after the Central European University left.
Yeah, exactly. So the Central European University was a really well-respected international uni, a kind of bastion of liberal values. And it was funded by George Soros, Viktor Orban's enemy number one. And that university very sadly got kicked out of the city in 2018. Orban managed to force them out through a legal dispute, and they're now based in Vienna. So the idea of kind of indirectly replacing that very pro-European university with a Chinese one that doesn't really believe in freedom of thought, it doesn't really look great for those of us who would like to see Hungary moving back towards, you know, properly embracing democratic values.
Okay, but this is Good Week. You were given the brief to, to come up with a good news story this week, and you're not doing very well so far.
I'm getting there. I decided to give this Good Week because people aren't taking this lying down. There were really big protests over it in Budapest over the weekend, which is obviously not great in terms of spreading coronavirus. But it is a sign of the fact that people really don't like this plan and they're willing to say so. One person who's been really standing up against Orban over this is the mayor of Budapest, Gergely Karaksan. He is a liberal and he's pretty ambitious. He's trying to beat Orban in next year's elections and become prime minister himself. And he is really, really unhappy about this Chinese university plan. And to show how unhappy he is, he announced that he was going to rename all the streets around the new campus. And all of these new street names highlight Chinese rights abuses. So one of them is called Free Hong Kong Road. Another one is going to be called Uyghur Martyrs Road. It felt like a bit of a PR stunt, but it's a PR stunt that made the Chinese government absolutely furious. Beijing said that this mayor was beneath contempt, I think was the phrase that they used. So that's got a fair bit of attention. And in the meantime, there are opinion polls showing that people really don't want this plan. One poll suggests that 2/3 of Hungarians are against it. And that also includes quite a lot of people who vote for Orban. You have to remember that even though the Chinese Communist Party doesn't really resemble a left-wing party in any meaningful way, it is still communist by name. And Orban built his career as an anti-communist during the fall of the Soviet Union. His supporters are pretty right-wing. So for him to get into bed with the Chinese Communist Party is quite inexplicable for a lot of his supporters. Even though if you look at their values, it's actually quite a lot that lines up, you know, like social conservatism, contempt for democracy. They have quite a few things in common. But yeah, this whole thing has actually been quite damaging for Orban. And the reason I'm giving it Good Week is that the protests seem to have made an impact. And the government is now very, very tentatively backing away from this plan. They've said that it's still very early days. This university isn't supposed to open till 2024, but they have supported the idea of having a referendum on it, which means that it could actually get voted down. So even though the background to all of this is quite disturbing and this general trend of Orban cozying up to Beijing, it's certainly not going away, the protests do seem to have made a difference.
Wow.
I told you we'd get there.
You did. And also the like opposition parties in Hungary are trying to unite at the moment, aren't they? And if the polls are to be believed, then it's going to be pretty close in the next elections.
Yeah, I've heard these are going to be the most competitive Hungarian elections in years. I think we're going to be there with our popcorn, Dominic.
That makes it sound like entertainment, Katie.
Sorry, it's really not. It's very serious. But yes, we'll be watching with a very close eye. Who has had a bad week?
It's been a bad week for the Prime Minister of Finland, Sanna Marin, after she found herself caught up in hashtag Breakfastgate.
Is that actually a hashtag?
Yeah, it actually is. Well, no, I think it's a hashtag in Finnish, but I translated it. Forgive me.
Oh, thank you.
And yeah, it's a scandal or maybe it's more of a storm in a teacup. Mm-hmm. It's about an eyebrow-raising amount of money claimed from the public purse to pay for her and her family's breakfasts and cold meals. Not the hot meals, just the cold ones.
Why is that a specific allowance?
Yeah, I actually haven't got to the bottom of that, why the hot meals aren't included. I think it's because a different service provides the hot meals, or... Yeah, I really don't know, and I should know the answer to that. But if anyone knows, tweet at us, please. And look, before we go any further, I should also acknowledge that this story isn't the most important thing that we could be talking about in Europe, probably, but I just couldn't let another opportunity to talk about food and politics intersecting pass by. So forgive me if this seems like a frivolous story to you. Is it frivolous? I don't know, actually. It's definitely not the bleakest of bad weeks, but hey, good week made up for that.
You're welcome.
But first, Katie, how much do you think Sanna Marin and her family were claiming each month for cold meals and breakfasts eaten in the official Prime Minister's residence? I should say that her family is her retired footballer husband, and their 3-year-old child.
Okay, so if the husband is a retired footballer, he probably wants like lots of protein. So there might be some meat in there, or some, you know, fancy meat supplements. The other thing I know about Finland is they drink a ton of coffee, don't they?
Yeah.
So I want to be quite generous on that.
And good rye bread is expensive as well.
That's true. I'm going to say, I think like 200 a month would be generous, but I have like quite stingy breakfasts, so maybe that's wrong.
You're quite far away from what they claimed. The number reported is 850 euros per month.
850 euros would cover like rent in a lot of cities. Like, how is that going on breakfast?
Well, it's not just breakfast. It's kind of been reported as if it was just breakfast, but it's the cold meals as well, which could be lunch, I guess.
Okay.
So breakfast and lunch together. And Finland is an expensive country. It's actually the 7th most expensive country in Europe for food, just above France and below Austria, according to Eurostat. And actually, interestingly, Finland has the highest price level for alcoholic beverages in the whole of the EU. 91%
above the EU average. That's not going in breakfast, is it?
No, of course not. I'm not suggesting that Sanna's been having champagne breakfast. And actually, I haven't been able to find out what her favourite breakfasts are, annoyingly. That's what I wanted to find out. And no one can tell me, other than the fact that she is a vegetarian. So, we can rule out meaty breakfasts, probably. No reindeer for Marin. According to Statistics Finland, the average family with two parents spends around 600 euros a month on all their food. So Marin and her family have definitely been claiming way above the average family meals. And yeah, as I said, it doesn't even include the hot meals. But I imagine the options from the catering service that provide to the Prime Minister's residence aren't the cheapest out there. And I'm not sure how much that is Sanna's fault.
So is there actually some suggestion that she broke the rules on this? Or is it just that the allowance was a bit stupid?
Well, the Prime Minister claims that she is following the rules as they were outlined to her when she became PM a few years ago. And she points out rightly that she is claiming along the same lines as previous Finnish Prime Ministers. But she does acknowledge that there seems to be a bit of a lack of clarity in the rules around the breakfast allowance. And the police are doing a preliminary investigation looking into whether or not too much money has been claimed for the Prime Minister's family. But it seems that even if too much was claimed, it wouldn't be Marin herself who is culpable in the eyes of the law, but the Prime Minister's staff who did the ordering of the food.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, it's her baby.
Yeah, it's all her baby's fault. A really weird Finnish legal quirk. But no, whatever the outcome, Marin seemed to conclude that the story was an uncomfortable distraction with local elections coming up this weekend. And she made the decision to pay back over 14,000 euros worth of breakfast and cold meal expenses. And she said she would no longer be using this allowance, whatever the result of the investigation. And potentially the bigger scandal than the amount of money claimed is the fact that she wasn't paying tax on her food benefits.
Ooh.
Yeah, normally in Finland, you do have to pay tax on benefits like food benefits that you get from your employer. And understandably, some people in Finland are quite resentful that a prime minister who earns 17,000 euros a month was claiming food without having to pay tax on those benefits like they do.
$17,000 a month and she gets extra money for breakfast.
Yeah.
That seems like madness to me.
That's her prime minister and parliamentary salaries put on top of each other. So yeah, it is an insane amount of money.
That's enough to buy yourself like really fancy eggs every day if you wanted.
Yeah, and it shows that her paying back 14,000 euros worth of expenses isn't that much. I mean, she's still left with 3,000 for the rest of her stuff. The Prime Minister's office has now asked the tax office to look into whether she should indeed be paying tax on any food benefits. So that rule might change now. Again, she was following the precedent of what other PMs have done in the past. So there's not much suggestion that she's done anything really naughty. That said, I think it's really good if, like, we are generally critical of expenses claimed by politicians. And I applaud the Finnish journalists for doing their investigative work. It may seem like a really small thing, but you could see it as a sign of a really healthy functioning democracy, that there is scrutiny and interest in the money spent on people in power. Now, that said, I do think it's a bit strange if you're like surprised about the amount that's spent on Prime Minister's food. I wonder how it would compare to other world leaders. I assume most world leaders spend a ridiculous amount of money on their breakfast, don't you?
I'm pretty sure the Macrons spent like decent money on their breakfast, given that Macron's makeup bill was like 26 grand. In 3 months or something like that, you'd think they're getting nice croissants in every morning.
Yeah, I agree. And there is a silver lining for Marin, which is that it doesn't look like it's going to cost her job, unlike there was that other Finnish expenses scandal last year when the finance minister at the time had to step down from the cabinet for having paid for expensive media training with taxpayers' money.
Yeah.
So it's not blowing up like that did. Nevertheless, it's been a bad week for Prime Minister Sanna Marin, who also rebutted rumours that she had used public money to go towards her wedding last year, which took place at the Prime Minister's residence, which is a ridiculously luxurious villa on the seaside with a sauna on the seaside and a tennis court in the ground. So, I mean, you really shouldn't be surprised if they're having luxurious breakfasts, I say. Prime Minister of Finland seems to have some perks.
We have two lovely new people to thank this week for keeping this podcast going. They are Sonia Rohan and Maynard Wade. This podcast has come a very, very, very long way since the early days when the artwork was produced by me on Microsoft Paint, but we're still very much a small operation recorded in our bedrooms each week. And the only reason we're able to keep it going is because of generous listeners like Sonia and Maynard. So if you would like to help make sure that we can carry on making the Europeans, you can donate as little as $2 a month in euros, dollars or pounds at patreon.com/Europeans podcast. You grew up in a very wet city, Dominic, London, England. Although I do think that London's reputation for being rainy is like actually not that deserved. I Googled it yesterday and it was a bit hard to work out, but I think that London is something like the 35th wettest city.
In the world?
In Europe.
Oh, I'm surprised how low down the rankings it is. And actually, it doesn't matter anyway because everyone's always underground on the tube.
Do you think that you appreciated the rain living in this notoriously wet city, or do you think you celebrated it as a good thing?
No. Definitely didn't. It was definitely a nuisance.
Well, the reason that we're talking about the rain this week is that we recently learned, as Dominic said earlier, about a plan in Gothenburg in southwestern Sweden, as part of the city's 400th birthday celebrations, to brand itself as the best rainy city in the world. They are taking the fact that it's really pretty wet there, and they're trying to turn it into a selling point for the city, something to celebrate. It's not just a slogan, though. It's not just a branding exercise. The city of Gothenburg is putting real money and resources behind this plan to become the best city in the world to experience when it's raining. And one of the things that they've done is to hire a chief kind of rain designer, I guess we could call him, to make all of this happen. Here's the artist Jens Toms Ivarsson, and we had a very delightful conversation.
How much does it actually rain in Gothenburg?
It rains about 40% of the days in a year. So that doesn't mean that it rains like 24 hours during those days. But sometime during about 40% of the year, it rains in Gothenburg. So we're the second rainiest city in Sweden. But I just also want to mention that for us, it's actually not about how much it is raining during a year, it's about what we do with it.
Right. So this is the thing. I mean, cities and architects are always having to manage the rain in one way or another. What is different about the approach that you're taking?
Well, I know there are only a few pictures that I've seen where architecture has actually used the rain. Usually, architects do not consider the rain as an asset to add value to the building. Usually, it comes on the roof, it goes into the pipes, and you don't see it anymore. And also landscape architects who is already working outdoors. How many parks have you been to where they actually thought through that it should be nice to be in the park when it is raining? It's not that many. There's so much to be done. And in Gothenburg, to be honest, we don't have that yet. We are working on, though. We want to make now one of the parks that we're working with to turn it into the best park in the world when it rains.
And could you explain what are some of the things that will happen in this park when it rains?
First of all, I would say that it has to be a place where you can be dry. You should be able to choose if you want to be wet or not. So that's step one. And of course, the second thing is to use the rain to create art. So when you're sitting at this dry place, you can kind of lose yourself, just like watching into, if you're sitting around a fire, a campfire, you can just sit there, be quiet, and just lose yourself looking into the flames. We want to create the same thing, but with rainwater, that create an installation where you can just sit, be silent, and listen to the rain and observe what happens. So that is what we're about to design now in this particular park, for example.
And then beyond the park, what kind of things are you doing to make Gothenburg the best rainy city in the world?
We have a school called Torslanda Skolan. It's an existing school, but it has to be renovated because it's such an old building. The architect company that won the competition, they said, let's do the best school in the world when it's raining. So that means that they are now gathering the water on top of the roofs. So the more it rains, the bigger effect it creates when it pours down. And from a pedagogic point of view for the children, when it is raining, they can play with the rain because it's created like canyons and things like that. And also that school that takes care of the water in a water management in a very sustainable way.
A lot of these projects seem to be centered around children. Can't adults have fun in the rain too?
Yeah, actually, the park that I mentioned, that's actually aimed more towards adults.
Ah.
It's like a pavilion that we will design, a rain pavilion. Actually, it's a good question that you have because children are not the problem. Kids, they love rain. They love water. They just jump in the puddles. Yeah. That's no problem whatsoever. It's us as adults and as parents. We are the problem. So we are also looking at how can we make people interested in rain to start with. And that's why we work with, example, poetry on manhole lids in the city. So we choose one poet each year and they get to be the manhole lid poet of the year. So in the casted iron, their poem will be written and they last for about 100 years.
I love that idea. It's just so nice.
Yeah, and the thing is that that's nothing new in a way. That usually in different countries, they do beautiful pictures on those iron-casted lids. But poetry, to work with poetry on them, is not that usual. And we like that the poetry is getting out in the public space for everyone. All of a sudden, when you walk down the street, you see this poem. We slowly do this because we want to create attention to rain.
Are you personally someone that has always enjoyed the rain and celebrated it, or has this project actually changed the way that you see it as well?
No, it has changed me for sure. I think I'm still like most people. If I could choose when I go outdoors, do I want it to be sunny or rainy? I prefer sun. I like being in nature, for example, and everything is much easier if I go out with a tent, or if everything is soaking wet, it's not as nice. But reality is that it rains. So why not try to do those days just slightly better? For me, working with rain now since 4 years, I actually changed. I don't mind rain so much. I mean, to live in a city, it's so easy. Just go indoors if it rains outside. And also that's the thing that we're actually looking at and discussing is if we say that our vision is to be the best city in the world when it rains, We do not want to exclude anyone. So that means we're looking at, okay, who is the most vulnerable? Homeless people, for example. If I would go up to a homeless person in Gothenburg and say, hey, you're in the best city in the world now, right? Especially now when it's raining, they would probably not agree with me. So we are talking to people that work with homeless people to see, okay, we cannot solve the problem with either that it's raining or the problem, at least not for now, with homeless people. But at least what we can do is to see what are their needs. We're pushing quite hard to see what does it mean to be human in a city when it rains. For me as a designer and artist, if someone would have asked me 4 years ago, Jens, your next dream job will be working with rain in a city, I would probably laugh.
It does seem like you were a pretty obvious person for the job, though. A lot of your previous design has been about using water in its various different forms. Where does your fascination with using water stem from?
I think like most people, there's something with water that we are drawn to that we like. But I mean, my very first job was as a stonemason. And when you work with stone, you use water all the time to cool your tools. So when you're grinding and all those things. And then I was a fireman for 2 years. And then you work with water as a tool to, you know, to put out the fire. And then it becomes a gas, steam. And then I started working with ice as a designer and sculptor. And then now I work with water, but in its falling state. Water is the only material that actually has this fourth, not only the solid, liquid and gas state, it's also in the fourth that where it falls down. I don't know why, it's just that water, when I look back on my career, it's been present no matter what I've done. It's always been working with water in different ways. My previous jobs that I had when I was creative director for the Ice Hotel in Jukkasjärvi in the north of Sweden, all those projects were fantastic and fun. And it took me several times around the world, but it was all in a very high-end luxury segment. It was only for a few very selected people to could afford that. So for me now working for a city where everything we do is for everyone in the city, for me, is very rewarding.
And how are the people of Gothenburg responding to this plan? Do they like it? Do they seem to be embracing it?
In the beginning, most people laughed and just said, ha ha, that's fun. Good luck, man. But more and more people now are not laughing anymore that much because they see it's a serious project. It's not about just jumping in puddles for kids or things like that. It's actually something that we do on all levels. Small, small, tiny projects and huge city projects.
Well, thank you so much for speaking to us today. We can't wait to come and visit Gothenburg in a few years and see
you. With our Wellington boots.
Yeah, with our Wellington boots and a good raincoat.
Yeah, you're more than welcome. And if you're really lucky, when you come and visit Gothenburg for like, say, 3 days, if you get what we have in a year, like 2 days of sun and 1 day of rain, that would be the perfect vacation, in my opinion.
I really like this idea of taking something that you're maybe a bit notorious for and putting a positive spin on it. And I was thinking maybe we could do that for Europe as a whole. And brand it as like the best semi-dysfunctional continent in the world. What do you think?
Yeah, or I was thinking the best boring political system there is.
We should workshop these. Thank you so much to Jens for joining us this week. We heard about his work via a lovely article in the Guardian newspaper, which we will post in the show notes. What have you been watching this week?
I watched a really lovely short video from the BBC about what is often described as the last matriarchy in Europe.
Yeah.
It's on the Estonian islands Kinu and Mania in the Baltic Sea. And the video follows a Norwegian photographer as she spends time with these women, photographing them and getting to know their extraordinary way of life on these islands where almost all of the men leave and women run everything. They're mainly pretty old women, as most of the younger women are also deciding to leave the island, putting the traditional culture of these islands at risk. But it's really worth watching the video. It's only 6 minutes long. I really enjoyed finding out about them, and I'll put a link in the show notes.
Nice. Can't wait to see that.
What have you been enjoying, Katie?
It's been a while since I plugged a Netflix series, so I figured it's now like socially acceptable for me to give them yet more free advertising on this podcast. I started watching Zero this week. Have you watched that yet?
No, I've missed that. What is it?
So Zero is an Italian superhero series with a mostly black cast. So it made quite a lot of waves when it came out. I think it's been out for a couple of months now. And it's a lot of fun. It's about this quite geeky, shy guy called Omar, who works as a pizza delivery guy. But he's also a talented artist. He draws manga characters. And guess what?
What?
He has a superpower. I don't think that's a spoiler. It comes up quite soon and it's in the trailer. But basically, Omar discovers that he can become invisible, which works as a pretty good metaphor in the series for how society sees him as a young black delivery worker. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. A lot of the media coverage of this series has been about the fact that it has a majority black cast, and that's something that has never really been seen on Italian TV. And a lot of black actors in Italy have seen it as really positive that there's now some opportunities to play roles other than the drug dealer or the refugee who's just come off the boat. I did read an interview, though, with the guy behind the series, the novelist Antonio Di Chele Di Stefano, and he said that he didn't want people to be talking about Zero just as the series with the black actors. He wants people to be celebrating the fact that it covers universal themes. The series deals with gentrification as one of its central themes. It's not like everything in the series is directly connected with race. But yeah, I think I'm going to carry on with it. I can always make time for a superhero show in my busy, busy schedule. And also the episodes are quite short. They're about 20 or 25 minutes long. So it's really good as like sneaky lunch break television.
You're so good at that. I need to get into my sneaky lunch break television. I'm always just doing sneaky lunch break podcast work.
That's not how to spend your life, Dominic. Live a little. The other thing I want to recommend this week is a lovely story from our friends at Are We Europe about pigeon racing in Belgium. It's a very lovely and personal story from Annelien Opoff-Treumann about her family relationship with this weird and wonderful sport. And it's got beautiful photography. It is well worth your time. I will put that link in the show notes. The show notes are just full of links this week.
Lots of homework for everyone.
You lucky people.
This week, I thought I'd close off the show with a very happy tale from Belgium, where a really observant lawyer was working through the French version of the official Belgian journal where laws and decrees are published, and hidden amongst a piece of legislation about the price of drugs and medical supplies was a recipe for asparagus.
What?
Somehow, someone had copied and pasted an asparagus recipe with six full steps into an official piece of Belgian law.
Ah!
It's not sure how this mistake was made or by whom, but presumably they were like bored typing up the French version of the legislation, fantasizing about dinner, and looked up a recipe and then copied and pasted that instead of a bit of law into it. Anyway, the recipe has now been taken out, which is, I think, a bit of a shame, but probably for the best. Anyway, congratulations to Morgan G. Moller for noticing this recipe and going pretty viral on Twitter last week after posting about his odd discovery. It made me laugh, and it definitely didn't play into any horrible stereotype about nothing functioning properly in Belgium.
I told you, we're the best semi-dysfunctional continent there is. I want this dish to become like a national dish in Belgium now. Can we please make that happen?
Yeah, let's do that. I mean, they take asparagus pretty seriously in this whole corner of Europe.
Oh, yeah.
I've discovered that when I buy like those little thin bits of asparagus, you know, the green stuff.
Yeah.
My husband and other Dutch people are just like, yeah, that's not asparagus.
Oh, because I thought Spargel was like a big thing in Germany. I didn't realize it stretched into the Netherlands.
Yeah, because they grow it here. And something I discovered recently is it's like really brutal to get out of the ground. It's like one of the worst jobs you can do.
Ah,
and that made me sad.
The things you learn.
There we go. Anyway, that's the end of the podcast.
You can find us on the social medias. You can come and hang out with us on Twitter at Europeans Pod and on Instagram and Facebook under Europeans Podcast.
This podcast is a part of the Are We Europe audio family. You should go and check out their other episodes at areweeurope.com/audio-family.
This week, the show was produced by Kat Slazlo and me. Our producers are Andrei Popovicu and Priyanka Shankar.
See you next week.
Hej då!